What do the recent electoral defeats in Argentina, Venezuela, and Bolivia mean for the present and future of popular struggle in South America? Have left-of-center governments in the region become disconnected from radical movements? What will it take to protect or restore the progressive gains made over the last decade? How have these supposedly progressive governments undermined the welfare of not only the broad working class, but also the indigenous peoples of the region? On this week's Global Research News Hour, we get perspectives from three guests: Binghamton, New York-based political analyst James Petras, La Paz-based activist Sarah Paulina Howergui, and Winnipeg-based publisher of Intercontinental Cry, John Shurto. On today's program, setbacks in Venezuela, Bolivia, Brazil, and Argentina, the future of the left in South America. Bringing you the analysis beyond the media headlines, the Global Research News Hour is on the air. Welcome to the Global Research News Hour for the week of February 26th, 2015. I'm series host and producer Michael Welch. The Global Research News Hour is a special radio collaboration between the Center for Research on Globalization and campus community radio station CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg on Treaty 1 territory. We seek to provide you with access to analysis of the major issues shaping our world today, from thinkers, researchers, and unique political personalities rarely addressed by major media. Our program is available from the Center's website, globalresearch.ca. We can also be heard on the Progressive Radio Network at prn.fm. We'll begin our show with News Notes, a sampling of articles from the Global Research News site. It is well documented that in 1996, U.S. and Israeli neocons advocated weakening, containing, and even rolling back Syria. As Michel Chalcedovsky points out, destabilization and political fragmentation in Syria is also contemplated. Washington's intent is no longer to pursue the narrow objective of regime change in Damascus. What is contemplated is the breakup of both Iraq and Syria along sectarian ethnic lines. That comes from the article, Balkanizing the Middle East, the Real Goal of America and Israel, Shatters Syria and Iraq into Many Small Pieces, by Washington's blog, posted February 24th. Turkey entered the war, albeit in a limited way, by shelling Syrian Kurds. The Russians braced themselves for an armed confrontation with Turkey, but only as a response in case of a full-scale Turkish invasion. This military preparedness, which included airlift of heavy weapons to the Russian airbase in Armenia, and NATO statement saying they will not fight if Turkey were to initiate belligerency, helped to undermine the Turkish resolve. The Russians went to the UNSC asking to censure the Turks, so they did, but in a statement, not by resolution, as the Russians wanted. Still, this statement cooled off Turkish minds, and it seems their desire to invade and to take a stand at Aleppo evaporated. That comes from the article, Russians Ride Fast, Russia's Victory in Syria, by Israel Shamir, posted February 24th, originally appearing at the UNZ Review. If Trump loses or is cheated out of the nomination by a unity candidate trotted out by the party elite, his organization will dissipate and fragment. If Trump wins the Republican nomination, he will draw support from Wall Street, especially if faced with a Sanders Democratic candidacy. If he wins the general election and becomes president, he will seek to strengthen executive power and move toward a Bonapartist presidency. The rise of a social democratic movement within the Democratic Party and the rise of a sui generis national populist rightist movement in the Republican Party reflect the fragmented electorate and deep vertical and horizontal fissures characterizing the U.S. ethno-class structure. Commentators grossly oversimplify when they reduce the revolt to incoherent expressions of anger. That comes from the article, U.S. Presidential Elections 2016, The Revolt of the Masses, by James Petras, posted February 25th. Heavy clashes are ongoing in several points along the Qanaser-Aleppo Road and the Sheikh Hilal Ithriya Road including the town of Qanaser, captured by ISIS in the recent days. At the moment, the both supply roads remain closed, despite the optimistic claims of some pro-government sources. Experts estimate the supply line to Aleppo will be hardly opened earlier than the end of this week. On the other hand, Qanaser could become a big operational trap for ISIS, with the SAA task to drag into combat as many fresh ISIS forces as possible and then to terminate them by massive air and artillery strikes with ground counteroffensive. Nonetheless, all will depend on the effectivity of the pro-government forces' actions. That comes from the article, Syrian Arab Army Implements a Big Operational Trap for ISIS, by South Front, posted February 24th. The documents, says Sarah Niner, are, quote, vivid evidence of the lack of empathy and concern for human rights abuses in East Timor, unquote, in the Department of Foreign Affairs. Quote, the archives reveal that this culture of cover-up is closely tied to the DFA's need to recognize Indonesian sovereignty over East Timor so as to commence negotiations over the petroleum in the East Timor Sea, unquote. This was a conspiracy to steal East Timor's oil and gas. In leaked diplomatic cables in August 1975, the Australian ambassador to Jakarta, Richard Woolcott, wrote to Canberra, quote, it would seem to me that the Department of Minerals and Energy might well have an interest in closing the present gap in the agreed sea border, and this could be much more readily negotiated with Indonesia than with Portugal or independent Portuguese Timor, unquote. That comes from the article, The Rape of East Timor, the Greatest Crime of the 20th Century, Executed and Covered Up, by John Pilger, posted February 25th, originally appearing at johnpilger.com. These are just a few of the featured articles appearing last week on the Global Research website. Regular visitors to the site are encouraged to send monetary contributions by fax, mail, or online. Just go to globalresearch.ca and click Donate on the menu bar. Last December, hard right-wing leader Mauricio Macri takes power in Argentina after more than a decade of center-left rule in the country. The same month, the right-wing Democratic Unity Roundtable Party defeated Maduro's United Socialist Party of Venezuela, founded by the late popular Bolivarian leader Hugo Chavez. Brazil's Workers' Party under President Dilma Rousseff is struggling in the midst of a recession and corruption charges. And just this last week, the president of Bolivia, Evo Morales, lost a referendum bid that would have extended his time in office one more term. All over South America, it seems that elements of the left are facing defeat. Do these developments signal the left's fall from grace, as a recent Economist article put it? What do they mean for the popular gains made over the last decade? To answer these questions, we turn to a scholar who has written and researched extensively on Latin American politics and has acted as an advisor to the late presidents Salvador Allende of Chile and Hugo Chavez of Venezuela. We're joined right now by Professor James Petras. Professor Petras is a prominent commentator. He is a retired Bartle Professor of Sociology at Binghamton University in Binghamton, New York, an adjunct professor at St. Mary's University in Halifax, Nova Scotia, Canada, an award-winning author and research associate with the Center for Research on Globalization. Okay, so over the last several months, we've seen what appears to be a lot of significant setbacks for center-left governments in South America. And I guess I'm wondering if, first of all, if you see are there similar currents running through the failures of these governments to connect with much of the their local populations?
Well, I think we have to go back a bit in order to answer that and put it in some kind of a meaningful context. These governments came to power at the beginning of the 21st century, by and large. And they were the outgrowth of a breakdown of free market capitalism and the attempts by the regimes to sustain themselves in the face of major bankruptcies and stagnant growth, growing unemployment and poverty, all of which intensified class struggle. A class struggle had an effect of radicalizing and drawing the middle class in alliance with the working class, the poor, and the unemployed. The radicalization was accompanied by a large-scale popular mobilizations, which in some cases, like Argentina, Bolivia, led to major uprising and the ousting of the incumbent regimes. These oustings, however, didn't lead to a revolutionary process. The left was into direct action, but was fragmented electorally. So in this political context, the left of center governments took power and proceeded to implement economic policies to promote employment and to fund the revitalization of capitalist enterprises. So they selectively nationalized and partially nationalized some enterprises, but mostly were developmentally oriented with a welfare agenda. Now, the political dynamics of this is that this radicalized and organized mass protest movement was demobilized. That is, they were taken out of the streets and put on welfare programs, or were given jobs, or provided opportunities to recover their savings from bankrupt banks, etc. And this was aided and abetted by the commodity boom of 10 years. This process of growth and welfare, however, had the effect of de-radicalizing the movements and creating electoral machines. Electoral machines which developed into clientelistic politics, in which the center-left governments depended on financing what you might call full-time functionaries, co-opting trade union leaders, social movement activists, etc. So this significantly created a situation in which could only be sustained by large-scale export earnings from agro-mineral prices and a capacity to fund both labor and capital, business, banking, agribusiness, and provide compensations for labor. This system recreated a middle class and a certain affluence among popular classes, who then saw their interests in terms of forming or becoming part of more affluent classes and no longer engaged in social solidarity. This in turn fragmented the working class and the popular classes. The majoritarian basis of the left governments. Moreover, the longer the left stayed in power, the more temptations or opportunities for their functionaries to engage in business transactions, corruption, to facilitate the growth of the economy and their own social ascent. The interesting thing about this process of de-radicalization is that these left governments successfully defeated U.S. intervention, military coups, destabilizations, etc. in the boom years, and so the U.S. Attempt to reassert its influence through illicit and violent means failed. Mm-hmm. However, with the growth of business power again, the U.S. found the electoral road more promising than the violent road and began to channel lots of funds into electoral politics. And then came the crash of the commodity boom, the decline in oil, gas, and metals prices, the decline of certain agricultural commodity exports. And this seriously weakened the left government's capacity to maintain welfare and growth. And as a result, inflation began to creep in, fiscal deficits grew, and unemployment began to have a somewhat of an impact. And so the left governments began to fall between two chairs. They weren't able to revive and weren't interested in reviving mass movements. And on the other hand, they had lost significant support among their middle class and lower middle class, and even popular support put off by the corruption and the long kind of arrogance of power. And this led to the recent debacles where Evo Morales lost the constitutional amendment this past weekend. The Chavistas lost the legislative elections. The Argentine left was defeated by a far-right business financial conglomerate, which has launched a campaign to cheapen labor and cut public spending. And in Brazil, there's a process of impeachment of the president Dilma Rousseff, and the story goes on. I think we can stop here and say one last word. However, it's that the extreme right, backed by the U.S., has already provoked a new wave of struggle from below that is independent of the previous left government, left center governments, and augurs a period of intensified class conflict in the face of this neoliberal revival.
It sounds like what you've been saying is that a lot of the problems facing these governments have been endemic, even though what you call the Anglo-American booby left, people like Noam Chomsky, who've been sent looking at the whole situation of progress of these left of center governments in that region as essentially through the lens of the anti-imperialist sentiments that have been expressed.
Well, Chomsky is really very ignorant of what goes on in Latin America. He picks up bits and pieces of information.
But he's very influential.
And then pronounces them with great solemnity. But most of it's off the wall. The fact of the matter is that these governments were not anti-imperialist in any meaningful sense. Most of the big corporations were in alliance with, signed off on very lucrative contracts in Bolivia. Practically the whole mining sector is joint ventures. The claim of nationalizing petroleum and gas is a fiction. They're joint ventures with major multinationals. Monsanto and Dreyfus and other big grain exporting outfits and agribusiness is endemic throughout Argentina. What these governments did, it had nothing to do with anti-imperialism, is they increased the tax and the revenues that they got from their joint ventures and used the high prices and the added revenue to finance welfare programs which accompanied ritualistic anti-imperialist declarations and attempts to diversify their markets. They denounced U.S. Intrusive behavior. And I think Chomsky and others like him in the U.S. and Europe simply looked at the rhetoric and didn't look at the underlying economic foundations that underlay these regimes.
It does appear, though, that the you certainly pointed out that the with the downturn in the price of oil, that came as a major blow, particularly to Venezuela. And I mean, do you buy into the idea that suppression of the price of oil may have been a deliberate?
Yes, but it was a policy accompanied the entire food section, the food distribution section, the entire banking system was continued in the hands of the private sector, who could sabotage and undermine any efforts to engage in distributive politics. The vast hoarding, smuggling, black market was possible because the government was very lenient or ineffective in generalizing the transformation. They concentrated on transferring oil revenues toward redistributive policies, social policies, without tampering with the enormous profits made by intermediaries who mouthed Chavista rhetoric but were essentially part of the capitalist class. And I might mention the enormous amount of corruption that was endemic in the Chavista political bureaucracy, and this alienated sectors of popular opinion. So I think it's the decline in oil prices. You have to raise the question, why was the economy dependent on 95% oil exports? What were they doing for 15 years in diversifying the economy and establishing industrial processing, agricultural economy to at least become self-sufficient in food production and in processing oil into byproducts, industrializing the oil? There's a lot to be said for the social programs and the independent foreign policy of Venezuela and the improvements in living standards, but the underlying foundations of the economy remain capitalist and in the hands of enemies of social welfare.
So, with regard to this de-radicalization that you referred to, is that something? Can the left become re-radicalized again, or are you seeing things?
Well, I see this process rapidly emerging in Argentina, and I think this is a very big fact that just yesterday there was a general strike. It was hundreds of thousands of public sector workers, teachers, private sector workers joined in a general strike against the Macri government and its firing of workers arbitrarily, its use of decrees and authoritarian measures to impose policies which in normal constitutional context would have required congressional approval. So the class struggle from below is being is reemerging very quickly, and quicker than I anticipated. At least this first general strike, with promises of more to come, and the government's commitment to wiping the slate and cheapening labor and attracting capital with higher profit margins. But inflation and the erosion of consumer power is quickly detonating a counter movement today, tomorrow, and in the immediate future.
So I guess I'd like to, looking at the various countries in terms of their influence on the larger geostrategic level, I guess I'd have to look like what are the critical linchpins that we have to look to that you figure the imperialist forces in Washington, for example, are most determined to lock down and make sure that any popular uprisings are quickly undermined.
Certainly ongoing ongoing relations between the Pentagon and the military and police training program, military training missions, bringing back of the Drug Enforcement Agency. NED was very much a National Endowment for Democracy, channeling funds in clandestine funds into the electoral campaigns. Propaganda, international propaganda, which emphasized whatever put a microscope to any economic weaknesses, any kind of corrupt practices. And I think Washington is going to put all of their resources to work to bring these rightists to power. They are going to try to force the transformation of the elected government in Venezuela. They're deeply involved in destabilization and a recall referendum of the president, as they were in Bolivia. And the governments can't engage in this kind of retreat and defeat kind of strategies. They've got to go on the offensive. They have to take over the principal economic basis for this political offensive, and that means nationalizing the banks, trade, and large-scale retail enterprises. What's at stake? Essentially, strategic political alliances. They want to incorporate Latin America into a U.S.-centered trading bloc and undermine Latin American integration. They want to have their capitalists have access to complete control over the natural resources in Latin America, oil and gas, and others. And they want to have a friendly a neighborhood in the sense of they want client states that they can mobilize in international and regional forums.
Mm. So, I don't know, are we seeing something like the a return to something like the free trade area of the Americas, which was...
Yes, I think that's what they're looking for. That's why Obama's going to Argentina to see how far he can push Macri or join with Macri in undermining the Latin American integration. UNISUR and the Mercosur and other regional organizations that developed in the past decade.
So what do you think would have to happen in the months and years ahead to counter
that?
Well,
what is happening is the center-left is declining. The right, hard right, is gaining force. And I think that the hard right, it means that there's no center position, that this is going to lead to inevitably intensified struggle from below. The pact between the center-left, the workers, the popular classes, and the entrepreneurs, that's over. We're entering a new period where class collaboration under the auspices of center-left governments is breaking down. So the hard right seizing control is going to inevitably provoke intensified social conflict. And it'll only be a matter of time before these conflicts begin to converge into some kind of new left political coalitions. It's not clear what these will be and how they will take form, but this has been the practice in the past.
Okay, Professor Petras, I want to thank you for your thoughts, as always.
Thank you very much.
We've been speaking with Professor James Petras, a prominent commentator and award-winning author and frequent contributor to the Global Research website. You're listening to the Global Research News Hour, broadcast out of Winnipeg on campus community radio station CKUW 95.9 FM and on the Progressive Radio Network at prn.fm. We are also podcast on the website globalresearch.ca. On Sunday, February 21st, voters cast their ballots in a constitutional referendum, which, if approved, would have allowed the president and vice president to run for a fourth consecutive term. According to Bolivia's election agency, the referendum had been rejected by 51.3% of the population, with 99.7% of the ballots counted. The result comes as a major blow to President Evo Morales, considered the most popular of the left-wing leaders in South America, although he and his socialist government, MAS, had been in the center of a lot of controversy in the weeks leading up to the vote. To get some sense of the popular currents sweeping the nation, and why Bolivians voted the way they did, and what this result could mean for the future of the country, we're joined by a political activist, Sara Paulina Haurgui. She's based in La Paz. So, Sara, thank you very much for joining us.
Hi. Thank you for joining.
Okay. Can you tell me a little bit about the activism that you are engaged in personally? What kind of causes do you typically champion?
Last year I organized this big event that was trying to draw attention for racist comments on social media against people from El Alto. And I just took like 700 people and made them eat on the floor of a very popular mall. And I also go to march and call attention on femicide.
Now, you supported the no side in this on Morales's referendum.
I think I don't have anything against Evo personally. But I think that if he could manipulate the constitution in his favor, like he wanted to, he could start doing that over and over again. So we should not give him the green light to do that.
I know that there was a lot of negative publicity of Mr. Morales in the weeks leading up. I mean, there was, for example, the charges of corruption. Do you feel that that kind of publicity may have had some impact on the vote?
Well, of course, and this is something that has been happening for a while now, that a lot of corruption and sketchy things coming from the government. But I think that Evo Morales doesn't realize that he has some people in his staff that has been stained with corruption cases, and he keeps them around him. The crimes go unpunished. So that's what people is witnessing. He promised us not to go back to corruption times, but he's doing it all over again in a major, much bigger way than the past government.
So it sounds as if the concerns, it's not that there's anything particularly wrong with the policies of the Morales government. It's just that he's surrounding himself with people who are behaving in these very shady ways.
Yeah, but of course there are some things that Evo is doing that it could be seen as wrong. Like, for example, he bought 80% of the media, and so now most of what you see in the news is something that has to be approved by the government. So we don't have free media. And the very few journalists that dare to inform people in a free way, they get cut out, or they get silenced, or the government starts throwing garbage and, you know, talking bad about them. So they set up bad publicity against this journalist, and ultimately they have to resort to leaving the country or just not working anymore. So that's one of the policies that maybe he's doing wrong, yeah.
It was a very slim victory for the no side, this referendum. I'm wondering what would have happened if it had gone the other way, if it had been 51% for the yes side instead of the no side. What do you think that would have meant for the political situation in Bolivia?
If Evo Morales had quit in this term, he would have made into Bolivian history as the best president we ever had because of his inclusive politics and the political and social stability that he brought to Bolivia. But he's failing very bad now in terms of corruption and of course he's not going to be able to keep the economy stable for so long because we're entering in a crisis, you know, like the whole South American region, who's maybe not going to be that big, but it's going to hit us sooner or later. So if he stays for 10 more years, you're going to see that he's going to burn out, you know. He's not going to live as the big Evo Morales that he is.
What about the right-wing forces within the society, people who may be more aligned with the Anglo-American, like Washington and so on, and trying to undermine some of the programs that Evo Morales may be putting in place? Do you see them as being emboldened in any way or helped?
Oh, yeah. They claim to be the leaders of the opposition that voted for no. But there's just a couple of old politicians, right-wing politicians. What they fail to see is that we have a new generation and we don't want to get back to the old ways. We don't want to get back to the Chicago Boys stuff. Policies. We want a new Bolivia, and we want a new Bolivia constructed by us. They still want to privatize our resources and sell it to big American or Asian or European companies. But we don't want that. We the young people really believe that we can do it from Bolivia and not the other way.
I wonder if you could maybe address this point. Is there anybody in his party that may be trying to say, okay, we've got to try to force you out, or is everybody united behind him?
Oh, no. There are rumors, okay? This is not confirmed by the media, but
Okay. Apparently
there's a war between Evo and the vice president. So they have their own bands, like their own teams, and they're fighting against it and against each other. And today I think Evo presented his new staff of ministers and he fired or ask for them to resign. He has new people in the government now. So I think that's what we can also his campaign. He fired his last campaign director just because he did something against him. And that's why this campaign for the yes was so disastrous. It was very bad. They went on the streets and they didn't realize that the campaign now has to be done in social media. So it was very bad. If you ask me, I think Evo's people is going to destroy his party.
Do you have an opinion about what the kinds of the forms of activism that need to take place moving forward? I mean, do you need to look at supporting individual candidates or individual parties, or just maybe ignore the elections and just focus on mobilizing in the streets? What kinds of things do you think you'll need to do in order to protect the gains that you've made?
What I've learned with this referendum is that people can unite for a common goal without anyone leading us and without a politician trying to lead us to a result. So the no is a win for the people without a flag, you know. So what I could do as an activist is just encourage that attitude to, like, not resort to politics, to actually get together and work for a better future. I think we can accomplish that because we just did it. We just won our first completely free of leaders election.
This wasn't the result you were expecting a month ago, was it?
I'm sorry?
The no victory? I mean, because it seemed as if a month ago it was looking like yes was going to win.
Yeah, it wasn't. We really were expecting in the beginning that they would manipulate or try to buy votes. And he also, we were hoping that, or expecting him to have to do something very surprising in the last minute to win votes, but he didn't, so no. But me personally, I always thought that the no was going to win because I really think that people could see that it was a very unnecessary referendum. Like, no one in their right mind would vote for your constitution to be violated just for just to keep in power. I mean, it's unreasonable. It's very bad. And no one would vote for that. Like, I think.
Okay. Well, Sara, I want to thank you very much for sharing these insights with us on this historical vote. I was wondering if you had any last thoughts you wanted to impart to our listeners before we close.
I just want to say that what I was saying before, that this referendum, I mean, this win doesn't mean we're going to get back to the old right policies. We really want to get back. We really want to keep going by ourselves and strong a bigger Bolivia for the future, but a bigger Bolivia from us. So we have 3.5 years to figure out what we're going to do after Evo. My hopes are that we are going to be a stronger Bolivia.
We've been speaking with Sara Paulina Jaurgui, a political activist based in La Paz, Bolivia. While South American governments have had to confront questions of working class struggle, accountability, and economic dislocation, there has been relatively little attention to the fates of indigenous peoples on the continent directly affected by the policies put in place and championed by those same governments. To talk more about some of those indigenous struggles,
not getting enough media attention. We're joined by John Aniwanika Shirto. He's the founder and editor of Intercontinental Cry, an online media resource detailing the rights, needs, interests, hopes, and the contemporary challenges facing the world's indigenous peoples. John Shirto, it's good to have you back.
For sure. It's good to be here again.
Yes. John, Brazil has been making headlines recently with the Zika virus scare, the upcoming Olympics in Rio, an economic recession, a massive corruption scandal, but there's been little attention to outcry over the president's rejection of a bill which would ensure indigenous communities can utilize their own native languages in basic higher and professional education. Can you tell us a little bit more about that?
Sure. Well, the law in question was rejected on the grounds that, according to the president and the government in general, was that this this law aiming to ensure that indigenous communities can utilize their indigenous languages in basic education, professional and higher education, as well as in their own processes of learning that respect their distinct cultures, was quote-unquote contrary to public interest. I guess the main reason for that, I suppose, was that it wasn't inclusive, I guess, in their eyes, or it was too too favorable towards indigenous peoples. That's the more moderate perception. But if we're going to look at this move in the general context of Brazil's anti-indigenous posturing, and with there's an entire suite of bills that are aiming at undermining indigenous rights and opening up indigenous territories to industry. Not to mention the strong growth of right wing sentiment in Brazil's Congress. We could see this as an explicit attack on indigenous cultures, which is also widely being ignored by the media.
Is this a posture on the part of the president? Do you see this as just a question of economic chintziness, or is there maybe some higher, economic interest at stake by basically recognizing and being able to kind of enhance what's already in your constitution?
Well, that's kind of what I'm hinting at, but I don't think it's economic. I think it's cultural. I would say that the Brazil government is very much opposed to indigenous peoples, and they are not going to be, at least not so much the courts. The courts have done actually a lot of tremendous work favoring indigenous rights, even passing laws that remove non-indigenous peoples from lands that were from indigenous lands that were illegally occupied, such as in Raposa Serra do Sol, and other regions in Brazil. So the courts have been doing impressive work, but the government itself is continuously taking this very anti-indigenous stance while constantly posturing itself as it did through the recent indigenous games as a human rights leader and an example for the world to follow. When it's not, when it's constantly, undermining undermining indigenous rights, going at indigenous communities, such as with Belamonte Dam, constantly pushing against any efforts that are focused on protecting the environment and maintaining the territorial integrity of indigenous territories.
Okay, well, I'm sure we'll have a lot more to say on this point as the Olympics get closer. I want to move on to Bolivia, because we've been talking a lot about that country over the course of this program, given the recent referendum and Evo Morales being ostensibly a left-of-center liberal leader, one of the more popular leaders in South America and the nation's first indigenous leader. But indigenous communities have been at odds with the government over its extractivist policies. Is it possible you could bring us up to speed on some of those indigenous impacts?
Well, I've done a lot of digging into this, and honestly, at this point, there hasn't been too many severe impacts in that the movements that the government has made haven't progressed to the point where indigenous communities are being wholly evicted, or where lands are being severely polluted or threatened, or in imminent threat of being contaminated by pipeline breaks and so forth. But for example, the government passed a supreme decree, decree 2366, back in May last year, which opened up Bolivia's 22 protected areas, primarily national parks, to oil and gas drilling. And as part of this extractivist policy that the government adopted, which is, you know, a far cry from the rather righteous posturing that Morales started out with as president, the government's made a number of very aggressive neoconservative moves against not only the environment but against indigenous communities and the capacity of indigenous organizations and foreign organizations, I guess, you know, international NGOs to mobilize and organize and educate and, you know, push against any pursuits for oil extraction. For example, it intervened in the affairs of two national indigenous coalitions, which split them into two factions, the one pro-government faction and then the so-called organic faction. The organic faction was, which focused on critiquing the government on mega projects, and you know, pushing the Bolivia's protections for indigenous rights and its, you know, its worthwhile consent process, which Bolivia has since altered. These leaders from these factions were, you know, locked out of their offices and shunted out of direct negotiations with the government. Bolivia also kicked an aid group, a Danish aid group, out of the country for supposedly, you know, fomenting resentment against Bolivia's national interests, when all it really did was, you know, publish a book on that taught indigenous communities about free, prior, and informed consent. This was, you know, against Bolivia's interests, apparently. So, you know, Bolivia's just been going on like this, much like Canada did with Stephen Harper and the aggressive approaches that he took to get control of movement, the capacity of everybody to organize for the sake of oil.
I think that's the first time I've heard someone make a direct comparison between the Bolivian government and the Harper government.
Yeah, it's weird, you know, especially considering the very impressive laws that Bolivia has actually pushed forward. Like not only the Mother Earth Law, there's one law in particular that Bolivia put forward in 2013 that actually criminalized. That focused on cultural genocide. So if there are organizations or companies who, you know, culturally disrupt an indigenous nation, finance the cultural disruption of an indigenous nation, cause environmental damage that leads to the disruption of a culture, they can be imprisoned. Which is like, actually, this is, you know, a landmark, a law. You know, no other government in the world has ever done anything like this. So on one hand, we have these, you know, these amazingly, you know, quote unquote progressive, visionary, perhaps is a better word, laws and regulations that Bolivia is pushing forward. But on the other hand, we have this very neoconservative agenda that Morales has apparently fallen prey to. And it's unfortunate, for sure.
So, John, I was wondering if you could, you know, with all of these numerous stories coming out, and Latin America in particular, have you, have there been any insights that you have received in all the years that you've been doing Intercontinental Cry, as you
look at these stories that are largely unaddressed by major media and even a lot of progressive media, and how does that shape your own understanding of struggles in Canada and in Turtle Island?
I think it influences it tremendously, actually. Like, I focus on Indigenous struggles globally, and seeing not only the commonality of struggle, but also the different strategies that Indigenous communities, nations, networks, organizations, and non-Indigenous use to deal with different situations or, you know, parallel situations, such as, you know, how Indigenous communities in Ethiopia will take on hydro dam projects, and then how Indigenous peoples in Brazil will, you know, take on the same. So drawing those connections and having you know access to that level of information, you know, provides an immense amount of insight that also allows me to advise others on concepts and ideas and strategies that aren't you know, readily apparent. For example, just here in Canada. Like, there's a strong strategy that the Kichwa community of Sarayaku pushed forward in their effort to protect their lands from oil companies, and they've won successively against the oil industry. You know, then they developed a strategy where they focus on long-term action on the local, national, and international level. And it's a paradigm that, you know, it's also being, you know, deployed in varying ways by different Indigenous communities around the world. It's an adaptable strategy, and it's one that, you know, that in Indigenous peoples in Canada really need to take note of. And I bring this up every chance that I get, you know, pointing to this strategy rather than just following the conventional model of activism that was, you know, made so popular in the United States during the civil rights movement. You know, that's not necessarily what we need here or what Indigenous peoples need elsewhere, right? We need strategies for the times and for the situation. So, you know, this research that I'm doing, you know, just, you know, is tremendously important. And it's something that, you know, every activist needs to do, you know, to not only to be, you know, in the know, but also to empower our own movements and efforts and perceptions. And something that I, you know, so I spend most of my time researching, actually, maybe not so much lately, but, you know, that's my primary focus is to, you know, make sure that I know what's going on and, you know, drawing the connections and making sure that I can put everything in a local, national, and international context for our readers.
Well, John Chertow, you know, it's a great site and a great resource. I want to thank you very much for coming on again and sharing these stories with us.
For sure. It's always great to talk with you.
We've been speaking with John Aniwanika Chertow, the founder and editor of Intercontinental Cry, an online media resource detailing the rights, needs, interests, and hopes and challenges facing the world's Indigenous peoples. You can get access to that information at intercontinentalcry.org. You've been listening to the Global Research News Hour. You can listen to our programs every week on CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg and on partnering radio stations across Canada and the United States. We are now also broadcast on the Progressive Radio Network at prn.fm. You can also download each episode from the website globalresearch.ca. To leave feedback on this program, email globalresearchnewshour@gmail.com. I'm series host, creator, and producer Michael Welch. Join us again next week.